What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Sikhist, S-I-K-H-I-S-T. Like always, we have a special one for you today. We're just sitting here with some tea. We got some cookies. It's a brutally cold flu season here in Calgary, Alberta, and we're braving through that. We got nosebleeds happening. We got fevers happening. But we're here, and because this is an important topic, I'm really happy to say that I can see that there's more there's more mental health awareness in our community now. Like, you can see events popping up here and there, and I think it's a very important topic. So today we have a mental health counselor. I'm just reading this to make sure I have it right. Her Harleen Kaur, and her IG is Blooming Minds Counseling, just in case I forget at the end. So we have Harleen Kaur here, and my wife is here as well. Harleen, you want to say hi?
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
The second one was my wife, just to be. So I just wanted to ask you about, you know, just start off with, like, what's your background? And are you a Sikh or are you not a Sikh? No, I'm just joking. Yeah, just, like, you know, just kind of your professional background and, you know, how you got into this field.
Yeah, so I started off with a degree in psychology. The working of the mind was just always really interesting to me, mostly because I wanted to learn about myself. That was what really drew me to psychology. And then from there, I kind of did some volunteer work and really enjoyed working with people in mental health and crisis and all these different things, with volunteering at Distress Center, which was a wonderful experience. And then I pursued my master's in counseling psychology, which I finished in 2019, which was really exciting for me. I've been working in the field for several years with Canadian Mental Health Association while I was doing my master's. And I'm working now as a counselor. So very happy and privileged to be in this place where I get to hear other people's stories and be a support for them in their journey.
That's great. I think it's always special when you can, you know, find something that you're passionate about and make that your career. Do you think that this is kind of where your passion lies?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I would. I'm very passionate about it. Really, honestly, starting from a place of working through my own kind of mental health journey and finding healing and growth through everything that I've experienced in life. And then kind of being like, wow, like, I have this ability to be really empathetic and compassionate. And it's something that really serves me and makes me feel like I have a purpose. So I feel really privileged to be in that space.
So what was it like, when did you know that you had this love for psychology and learning? Like, at what point was it, university, or when did you begin to kind of fall in love with this field?
I think I've always been a very, like, sensitive, in tune person with my emotions. So that's something that I've always really searched for within myself and other people and connected on that level. But when I was in university, I'd started off in biological sciences, like lots of us start off with. And I didn't enjoy my classes. And when I took intro to psych, I was like, wow, this is really amazing. Like, this really fits for me. And I'm excited to go to school and learn about this. And just that excitement kind of was feedback for me that, yeah, this is right. And then I just kind of took it one step at a time and kind of saw where it led me and explored volunteer opportunities to see that if it would be a good fit. And when I volunteered, I really found that it was something that was such an easy flow for me. To be at the Distress Center, to be a support for other people, it's something that made me feel really good and also challenged me in different ways. And it felt like, okay, this is something that I think I can pursue as a career.
So was it like an option that you took that kind of drew you towards that field?
Yeah, exactly. It was an option. And then once I took that in the spring of my first year, I was like, yeah, this is it.
So I had no idea. I didn't know that because that's been my journey exactly too. Mm-hmm. Like, I started off wanting to go into med school because that's where. And then an optional course was psychology. And then, yeah, I fell in love with that too. I'm curious. When you worked, because I've known you for such a long time, mm-hmm. and since you were very young, and I noticed that you were very emotional, mm-hmm. very emotional. And all of a sudden, through your job at the distress center, there was a huge like change in you. And that was very inspiring. And I wondered what happened. Mm-hmm. You were regulating your emotions really well and stuff. Like, what happened there?
Yeah, I think that last part of what you just said, I learned how to regulate my emotions. That was the biggest thing. Kind of growing up being an emotional, sensitive person, like those were the labels that were put on me. And I kind of felt like it was a weakness of mine. And so when I started at the distress center, I was like, wow, this isn't a weakness. This is like a strength that I have. This is powerful to be able to connect to yourself at that level and to understand all these emotions. But I just didn't know what to do with them. And I would often try and run away from them or kind of see it as a weakness. And so it was this big shift for me through learning to be there for other people. I learned how to be there for myself.
That's fascinating because I remember you going to Sikhi camps a lot. You mm-hmm. loved camps.
Yeah.
And I know Saj would teach a lot of those camps too. So yeah. That's kind of how I got to know you. And how did that journey, that emotional regulation, help with your Sikhi?
Yeah, wow. That's a really big question for me. My mental health got so down actually with my Sikhi at one point, because I used to believe that if I didn't do X, Y, and Z, I was a bad Sikh. And that came with a lot of guilt for me. So kind of my first couple years of being an adult, I had a lot of pressure on myself. I got to figure things out. I got to know what I'm doing. I got to be a really good Sikh and do all these things. And I was really struggling. And my spirituality really suffered at that point. For a few years, I actually believed that Guruji didn't love me anymore. It was devastating. It was probably like the greatest loss that I felt in my life. Mm-hmm. And when I started volunteering at the distress center and just pursuing more studies in psychology and learning like how to support other people, I started thinking, okay, this is something I need to do for myself. And that's something I've always done, is anything that I want to encourage other people to do, I first make sure, like, is this something that works? I try it with myself, right? And you got to walk the walk, right? Before you talk the talk. So yeah, and so through my experiences, I kind of started to learn to be more self-compassionate towards myself, and I kind of started to restructure how I saw Sikhi mm-hmm. as well, and I realized that Waheguru isn't this person that I have to, like, live up to what they want me to do, and it's not black and white. It's not about being good or bad, and you're bad, so if you don't do everything right. And, you know, I had realized that was so, so fearful. Mm-hmm. It wasn't serving me. Mm-hmm. And it severed, like, my connection to Waheguru, actually, mm-hmm. Where I was so sad. And I was, like, pretty much grieving for, like, a good year or two and mm-hmm. feeling really down. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't talk to anyone about it either, because there was, like, all this guilt. And mm-hmm. I didn't know how to explain how I felt. And, you know, I still viewed my emotions as being a weakness. So how was I supposed to talk about it with other people? Because prior, like, a lot of my experience in high school, sharing my emotions with people, like, I had, like, close friends that would tell me that I'm really weak and I needed to be stronger. And so when you get messages like that, you just kind of learn, no, I shouldn't share this with other people, right?
So on the topic of emotions, so when you're studying psychology, mm-hmm. You're taught emotions differently. They're a part of you. They're like, you deal with them differently. And then you're taught self-regulation. Whereas when you're growing up within Sikhi, it's a little different. You could be taught that they're the banchot, or they're bad for you and you shouldn't feel that way. And it's contradicting. And so how did you balance that? Because I feel like you get different information on both sides. So mm-hmm. How did you balance that?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that helped me to start seeing things a little bit more clearly and finding a path that kind of served me better in terms of, like, incorporating my psychology experience as well as my Sikhi and kind of feeling happier in my life was honestly the concept of ick. When I started to pick up on that concept,
So before we get to that concept, would you say that it hurt you? Like, did that idea hurt you, that your emotions, like, you're not supposed to feel a certain way versus learning how to actually deal with your emotions?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Because I was living this life of, like, oh, my God, I'm really sad or angry, I'm bad, and, like, just trying to suppress everything a lot of times. Or I had ways to channel it. Like, I was very fortunate. My family growing up has always been really open to talking about things, so I always had the opportunity to talk about things. I had a lot of hobbies and stuff, so I had ways to channel it, but there were still things I was suppressing a lot. Mm-hmm. And just that guilt and that view, it was like it stunted my growth in a way. Mm-hmm. And then it got to a point where it kind of severed my like connection, and I kind of felt lost and confused for a little bit. So
so there's a lot to unpack there, I think. You know, a lot of people might be going through that with their religion or Sikhi, quote unquote, right? I mean, we've talked about our journey, and I think that whole, what you were saying about how you have to live up to this perfect ideal standard. Mm-hmm. How can you be happy if you have to live up to that standard, right? If there's no self-acceptance, if there's no self-love. Mm-hmm. And then even like from my point of view as a guy, like being emotional is not, is very weak, is a lot of weakness, is right. You're considered super weak, right? Mm-hmm. But even mental health, it's so stigmatized in the Western and just in society in general, and in our community, especially in our community. It's hard to, like, you know, get even like the definition of what mental health is, right? Like, I think someone was saying, like, if someone had a broken arm, you wouldn't just say, suck it up. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, go to the doctor, get a check. But if someone says, I'm feeling depressed, you say, suck it up. Yeah. Right? And that's like, that's very dismissive. Mm-hmm. And with Sikhi too, like, my biggest thing was like, oh, you're a Khalsa. Why are you depressed? Or you shouldn't, you don't you dare tell anyone you're depressed, mm-hmm. because people are going to look down on you. And you're supposed to be like saving the world, and you can't even save yourself. And it was just this weird dogmatic type of sick, like, religion that I'm so happy after discovering ick, like you said, mm-hmm. and getting out of that, mm-hmm. right? Because it was like, no, you know what? It's not about the Mr. God, quote unquote, in the sky. It's mm-hmm. about your connection with you, mm-hmm. and your higher self, and creating that self-love.
Yeah.
Right. So on that note, I wanted to ask you, maybe can you define exactly in your terms what mental health is? Mm-hmm. And then maybe we can talk about the stigma of it and stuff.
Yeah. For me, mental health is just honestly your well-being within your own mind, how you feel with yourself, the relationship with yourself in a way. Some people look at it in different ways. You could say it's your feelings, your thoughts, your, you know, things, your beliefs about yourself, the stories that we tell ourselves, how we understand the world, how we understand ourselves. I don't really like to have very pinpoint definitions for things, because I think people will relate to concepts in different ways. But I think it's honestly your health, taking care of yourself. And we've really had more of a focus on your physical health, like, you know, you're feeling sick and it's like, oh, yeah, I can take a sick day. But what if you're not mentally feeling well? What does that mean? What does that look for you? And giving that attention and focus is so healing in so many ways. It's so important, because that can be overlooked.
In your field, is there any parameters that we can go by that someone can say, you know what, maybe my mental health isn't so good? Like, someone might be listening to this and thinking they're okay, or because that's how I was for the longest time, right? Like, mm-hmm. I went through depression and all that without even knowing it was, right? Just to be on the real, right?
Yeah.
And someone might be just like, oh, I didn't realize, like, is there any parameters to look out for, maybe that that someone can recognize what, you know, that they might be having issues with their mental health?
Yeah, definitely. Honestly, if you're not happy, that's pretty like simple, but you might be losing motivation towards doing things. You're not finding joy in things you typically do. You're feeling really no motivation, and it can look like a lot of different things. You could be worrying all the time and just feel a lot of tension and anxiety in your body. It can come from so many different things, right? And it could come from traumatic experiences you've had in the past, from not having supportive, loving environments growing up, or even in the present having supportive, loving relationships, and the really the your self-talk, like how you talk to yourself. You're often criticizing yourself all the time, right? Which is huge. We really overlook that a lot. And it's, you're living with yourself all the time, you know? So if you feel awful inside, like something will kind of tell you.
So with the self-talk, right? For the first time, I realized what self-awareness was. Like, I mean, it's a cool word to say self-aware. Are you self-aware? Are you becoming self-aware? Self-aware. But like when I started actually becoming self-aware, I realized what it meant. I'm like, oh, being aware of the self. Yeah. Right? Because I didn't even realize how negative I was towards myself. Yeah. I didn't realize that there was a negative voice in my head that was constantly putting myself down, right? Like, you're not good enough, or you screwed up, or you haven't done enough, or your past is like this. Always there, right? Yeah. And I didn't realize that I had a very strong negative voice that was just, I was so used to it that it was just a part of my mind until I did some real, through the Nanak Nam, right? I did some real meditation. I did some real, like, you know, self introspection, some journaling. And then I don't know, I just started I noticed that voice when it started getting dimmer. I was like, oh my God, you are here. Because I would do something and then this negative thought would come up and I'd be like, where did that come from? And I'd try to replace it with a positive. But I didn't even know I had that negative thought.
I think absolutely. Like it's so hard to even sometimes recognize that you're feeling a certain way. And how do you do that? Like, how do you figure out, oh, because like with me, a few years back, new people would meet me and they'd say, why do you look so sad? And I'd look at him like, what do you mean? I'm not sad. This is just my resting face. Like, what are you saying?
Sad resting face.
Like, what are you saying? What do you mean? And it was really hard to, like, sometimes it's not that easy to figure out, oh, I am sad inside. And so I have to say, like, having a mindful practice has helped so much in noticing just what the sensations in my body are sometimes. And you've helped me so much through all these things, like labeling my emotions and like really learning how to listen to how I feel inside. And then it's progressed to, noticing my thoughts, my thought patterns. And sometimes it's surprising. It's like, oh, that thought popped up and it's not a very nice thought. Like, where did that stem from? You're kind of like, I was going through life for many years on this, feeling this numbness and just doing my, daily netanim, whatever at that time meant for me. Whereas, you know, you're just going through life and you don't even realize what you're doing. You're kind of on autopilot mode until you're mindfully practicing, you're noticing what's going on inside of you, in your thoughts and surrounding. And that's when I feel like I started recognizing, okay, I feel sad today. Or, you know, there's anger here. Where is that stemming from? Okay, well, then going back into the childhood and then figuring out the trauma and then trying to correct that. But yeah, it's hard to notice that sometimes.
Yeah, that's honestly like the biggest journey is just figuring out what is even happening right now. And that's so true. And I think that like there's so much bravery that both of you have and that courage to even start looking inside, because it can be so scary to do that. We're kind of almost programmed to be afraid and like shut that off and like pretend we're all okay and put this mask on, right? And so taking that step towards like, hey, what's going on in here? And like that takes like a certain amount of like bravery to do that, honestly. Like I say that to my clients too, even coming to counseling, being in a space, whatever that step is for you to start looking into yourself, like that takes strength, right? And once you start that, and when you take it in a non-judgmental, mindful way where you're just observing what's happening, like that's the key, I think, is oftentimes we start judging ourselves right away. That was like the biggest lesson for me, to like honor my feelings, even the ones that weren't pleasant. And like, yeah, my sadness is allowed to be here. You know, my anger can be here. And when I did that, it just took so much power away from that emotion. I didn't feel like I had to like control it all the time, because it was like, yeah, I can feel sad or mad about something.
Oh my gosh. So I just realized there's this line in Barney about grode. We don't go or be around angry people, right? Yeah. I can't remember the line right now. But so I remember just feeling like a few years back, like this rush of anger sometimes. And I'm just like, I didn't know how to channel it. And then I would have to hear that line from some people around me. And it would make me, it was sort of like a put down. Like
you got
it would,
labeled, right?
I got labeled. Yeah. And it was like, oh my God, there's something wrong with me. Mm. And then, you know, years later, it's like, oh no, emotions are okay. Mm-hmm. This is actually an underlying problem of many other things that you're feeling right now. You have to work through that stuff. Mm-hmm. That was huge.
Yeah. It's not you. You're not angry.
Yeah.
You're not angry, quote unquote. It's just anger is happening to you for whatever reason, which is what you have to actually explore. I think the one thing that you said was very important. When you said that, so there's one thing where it's like you're talking down to yourself all the time, right? Which I didn't realize I was doing until I started realizing this voice, right? When it was kind of getting quieter through positivity and positive meditation and whatever, that voice started getting, I started accepting myself. I started actually like, you know, not to sound too, you know, not... you know, tough enough, but started loving myself, right? <That's> awesome. loving myself, love. But what I was going to say is talking to yourself in a negative way is not the way to go. But how you said when you self-reflect without judgment. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started doing. And you know what helped me the most is the concept of identity. So you know how we believe that we're not our name, we're not our body, we're not our mind. This is all in Nanak Nam videos, right? Yeah. So who are you? Mantu Jyot Srupa Aparna Mool Pashan, right? Like you are that higher being, right? Mm-hmm. Connected, right? That you're not, because none of these things go with you, right?
Yeah.
It's part of Maya, so it's not here. So when I started really realizing that I'm not even my name, I'm not even what I've worked for, right? I'm not my body. Then I was like, okay, then why are you sad? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and I started looking at myself like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, like, and I started being able to identify my weaknesses without judging, because I didn't identify that much to myself anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't identify that. I couldn't even look at myself because I was so identified with my emotions and me and my psyche and my identity, right? Mm-hmm. That I couldn't look at my weaknesses. Mm-hmm. When I stopped identifying that I'm not even any of this, then I was able to look at my weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh man, yeah, you are weak here. Oh yeah, you are. But without judgment. And I know that's hard to, it's hard, might be hard coming across like, oh, but you're calling yourself weak. No, I'm not. I'm saying this is a weakness of mine that I need to work on. Mm-hmm. But that's the key. How do you do it without judgment? So that was a very big point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference between self-negative talk and actually taking a look at yourself with love and saying, okay, how can I improve here?
Mm-hmm. That's huge. And the biggest thing that I was kind of thinking as you were saying that was that you are not your emotions.
Right.
Right. Because we often think anger, I'm angry, that's all I am, or whatever you're experiencing, you associate that. And like my training and kind of line of thought is people experience different things. So you're a person who might have experienced depression. You're not a depressed person.
Right.
And that might be such a small distinction, but really it's huge, right? Honestly. And just think about that. Those two lines that's that I just said, those words, they're powerful.
Yeah.
It makes a difference. Think about the words that you tell yourself every day, right? Mm-hmm. And that concept of self-reflection needs to come from a place where you're able to recognize that you have so much potential, so much love, so much energy that can be transformed into different things. And you're not just the anger you're experiencing or the trauma you've experienced or whatever it is, right? You're so much more.
Is that maybe where that stigma comes from then, when people are starting to identify themselves, like, I don't want to be labeled a depressed person.
Yes.
Like, why? Like, am I coming out here telling people I'm depressed? And people are going to be like, oh, this guy's just a depressed case or something, right?
Yeah.
So you think that's where that stigma is coming from, right? Like, that line you said is so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally resonate with that, because even when I was in a really low place, I could not fathom telling anyone that I wasn't okay.
Yeah, honestly, me too.
I really couldn't. Like, yeah. The thought of doing that freaked me out even more. And I was like, no, it's better for me to just, like, be by myself. And everyone thinks that I'm, like, this person that's, like, has it all together and everything, right? And it wasn't until I was in a really low place and I was, like, kind of forced to tell, like, my parents and my brother. And it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. Because they knew I wasn't okay, but I just wasn't talking about it, really. And when I started talking about it, I was like, oh, okay, like, I'm going through this right now. But, you know, one analogy we kind of use to describe our emotions is that they're like waves in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a really strong wave will come and you'll notice it comes towards the shore of the beach and it'll linger there for a little while and it'll kind of take time to go back. Sometimes it's like there's smaller waves and they kind of go back quicker. Mm-hmm. Like, emotions are temporary. Mm-hmm. But when you feel those sensations in your body, it freaks you out because it's so unpleasant. Yeah. But honestly, you feel those sensations for less than a minute. Mm-hmm. But it's learning all these different tools of, like, how can I be okay and start honoring these unpleasant emotions and experiences and know that this is a part of life. Mm-hmm. And that's what started resonating with the concept of emotions and Sikhi to me, because there is this concept of, like, being okay with, like Sikhs that are in Chardigla, that are in, like, high spirits, that there's no difference between pain and happiness. And that would never make sense to me. I'm like, no, but I just want to be happy all the time. Yes. I don't want to experience pain. Like, what does Maharaj mean? And then when I started thinking about learning more about the emotions and how it's not necessarily good, bad, that putting judgment on things isn't helpful. Putting labels, like, in a negative way isn't helpful. It really started to shift things. I'm like, okay, I can see where Guruji is saying you can experience pain and happiness. Like, it's just something you experience, right?
Okay, I have a question for you guys. So,
can I just add to that?
Yeah, before? Please go ahead.
So just to add on that, what you said about honoring your emotions. Mm-hmm. So it took me a while to actually realize that my emotions were actually hindering me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, emotions are part of Maya. Mm-hmm. It just kind of clicked one day, right? I was like, wait a minute. Me being, like, always wanting to be happy, or me just going after this, like, emotion of happiness, right, is something that I need to figure out, like, how to go beyond. And I think honoring your emotions, the way I used to, you put it in a really beautiful way. And the way I used to think about it after discovering Nang Nam was the hukum thing, right? Where, like, if you're feeling an emotion, accept it as the hukum. Like, don't get mad at yourself. That's another thing we do. Like, well, why did I get angry? I'm not supposed to get angry. Or why did I get frustrated? I'm not supposed to be frustrated. No, man, you got frustrated because you got frustrated. That's fine. Accept it. Honor it, like you said. Mm-hmm. But now let's work on how to make sure it doesn't happen again. Right. So I think that for me was really important, like, accepting yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. So when you did feel that you don't, you know, like, go and beat yourself up more about it because you're supposed to be better than that. But at the same time, for me, it was like I realized that I don't want to be in my emotions so much because I, like you, I was very empathetic. Mm-hmm. If I saw something on Facebook, like some crazy thing that happened, it would bug me for months. Mm-hmm. And I thought that made me a better person. Right. But I realized that, like, I need to, like, regulate and I need to, like, work on myself and realize that, you know, everything is in hukum and I need to work from that. Mm-hmm. Instead of, like, I realized that my emotions started becoming kind of like addictive to me. Like, I was like, I wanted to be in that state a lot. Right. Mm-hmm. So now it was like, I realized, okay, I'm going to try to detach a little bit from these emotions and try to stay in a place of surrender mm-hmm. and acceptance.
So I have a question based on emotions. So would you guys say that there's a lack of emotional maturity in general? We're not taught how to be emotionally mature, whether especially if you're being raised in the quote unquote religion mm-hmm. or just like this is something we're not taught in schools and we're not taught at home. And I feel like that's like the biggest thing that I've learned is through this mindful practice is that there is a way to connect with your higher self so that you are not so much in your emotions. And that's kind of probably the state that the Sikhs we talked about were in all the time, because just if you're able to tap into that space for even a second or two, you realize, oh, I don't feel wavy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't feel my emotions, and I'm like pretty like okay, and it's a good feeling because there were times. Okay, let's talk about attachment for a second too. There were times when, you know, they say more or monika now, or like don't love your child so much because that's more, and mm-hmm. I'm just like, what do you mean? I love this feeling of being able to love my child unconditionally, and mm-hmm. isn't like this why like. You know, the bond of a mother and a child was created. What's wrong with that? Like, mm-hmm. I can't force myself to not love my child or have that. The attachment is there. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely. And it was scary to think that, oh, I don't want. And it was hard to admit at the time because I think sometimes, oh, I don't want, this sounds weird to be religious, so religious that you're not attached to your children. And it was hard to kind of grasp that mm-hmm. Aspect of it. But it was easier when I started accepting my emotions and just seeing Vaheguru and everything in that like the child and everything, and that everything that I began doing was sort of more of a service. And then, you know, being more real about yourself, tapping into your authentic self, that helped me see that, okay, this is probably the state that the six were in and they were talking about, and it's actually a beautiful place to be in because it's sort of a state of love where you love unconditionally everything and everyone around you, no matter what. So, sorry to derail, but I know you have, you know, you talk about politics, edge, and emotion, right? Like, I love that. And also just emotional maturity. Like, I was never taught that, and it took a long time for us to grasp that concept and come across it.
What, so, you want to define emotional maturity for yourself?
I'll let Harleen, yeah. Emotional maturity.
I think we talk about emotional intelligence or as a way of like being able to connect to your emotions and recognize what's happening within yourself.
Yes.
And knowing like what to do with that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of one way of looking at it. And I think it really depends on the environments and that we grow up in, the people around us, because as children, we pick up honestly based on like our parents and whoever's around us, right? And so however they emotionally regulate, we learn to do the exact same thing, right? We're mirrors. We mm-hmm. repeat those behaviors and ways of being. And as we start getting older, you know, maybe some people learn things depending on whatever they go through, if their aunts and uncles and other people in their lives or friends. And it just really depends on who's around you, and maybe you'll pick it up. And it's not something that I think has always been focused on in schools. Mm-hmm. And I think they're starting to do that a little bit more now. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate that sometimes I hear stories that like a kid died by suicide and then they started, you know, talking more about it and things like that. But I think the stigma around mental health and around emotions and being connected to yourself mm-hmm. is slowly something that is changing over time. Mm-hmm. And I think that once we're adults, we kind of see, okay, this is where I'm at right now. And your parents did the best they could, you know. I think almost every parent has the intention of loving their child, and, you know, mm-hmm. and everyone has different struggles, and they just know how they know how to emotionally regulate and whatnot, right? And then once we're adults, it's like kind of learning, okay, it's like you have to parent yourself again in a way. Mm-hmm. Figure out like, what is this relationship with my mind and myself? How do I operate? Is this really effective for me? Like, am I feeling good? Am I being able to get you reach my goals and do the things that I want to do, or are things blocking me, right? And then what that looks like can be different, right? Like, it might be that's why services like counseling exist. Like, I'm someone that's gone to counseling before, just to have a space that's unbiased to be able to work through some stuff and not feel like I'm gonna, you know, negatively impact whoever I'm talking to and whatnot, and just get some more tools on like, what do I do, you know? Because yeah, we don't know what to do sometimes, and sometimes we don't pick up those tools, right? So it's like a conscious effort on our parts to learn those tools, to learn to connect to ourselves, to be okay with those unpleasant emotions, and to kind of learn what feeds us, what doesn't. How do you take care of yourself almost? Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I'm learning to see it now. Mm-hmm. Taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So exactly what you said, like with emotional maturity or emotional intelligence, you know, I liked what you said about how it's about being able to recognize your emotions and work through them. Right. And maybe be less moved by them, mm-hmm. up or down, mm-hmm. you know, like getting super happy about something and then getting super sad about something. Right. Mm-hmm. So the issue here is, what's the external stimuli? There's always an external stimuli that's making you happy or making you sad. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of like regulate how you respond to external stimuli, mm-hmm. right? By not being so like there or like up or so down, and just being in a state of acceptance. That's what the state you were talking in, mm-hmm. right? The surrendered state. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, it's like this feeling of so much immense power because this external stimuli mm-hmm. is not affecting you. Mm-hmm. And for me, like you said, I've had glimpses of it. It's not like I'm always in that state, but mm-hmm. I've had glimpses of it through the practice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think with the politics thing, you know, it's interesting. I think what I realized was I was like a hardcore emotional person without realizing it, until I realized and I stepped away from my emotions. I realized how much they use emotional manipulation in politics, mm-hmm. right? With politicians, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to galvanize one side, like the left, right? They know exactly what to say and what issues to talk about. That gets everyone so emotionally riled up. And if you want to galvanize people on the right, people know exactly what to say to get everybody riled up. And I realized, okay, these people have figured this out like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, right? Like, how do we manipulate the masses so that they come and vote for us? Well, the best way is everyone's attached to their emotions. Let's put some emotional stuff out there, right? Mm-hmm. When I stepped away from my emotions, I stopped being manipulated emotionally, like mm-hmm. politically. And I was like, okay, let's just look at the facts here, mm-hmm. right? Like, what does this mean or what does that mean, right? And, you know, like some people call it like identity politics or dog whistle politics, right? But it's something that I would really suggest our listeners like to really try to implement in your life. Don't be so emotional, right? Mm-hmm. Like, don't let your emotions drive you, because emotions can be a smokescreen. People can use your emotions to really trick you, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's something that you start seeing when you don't identify so much with emotions. While we're talking, if I can think of an example, I'll come up with it. But did you want to add anything?
Yeah. One concept that we kind of teach is called the wise mind. Mm-hmm. And that's what came up to me as you were chatting. So there's kind of one part of us that's like our emotional mind that reacts a lot based on emotions. Mm-hmm. And then there's another part of us that's that more logical mind that, you know, thinks about things factually. And the wise mind is actually a connection between both of them. So you don't want to completely ignore your emotions either, because we kind of describe emotions as being like signals in a car. Like, they're letting you know that something's up and they're there for a reason. Your body's is kind of created to notice when there's some danger. But sometimes, you know, it might be overreacting to danger. So you have to be able to notice what's happening. But at the same time, you need that logical part of you to be like, okay, my emotion is telling me something's up. Okay, is something really needing this much attention or not? And that's where I think there's that mixture of your logical and emotional mind, and the concept of the wise mind comes up. So utilizing your wise mind to make mm-hmm. decisions, I think, is really powerful.
Can you suggest how you might utilize the wise mind a little bit more?
Okay. So if I'm really upset about a situation, for me, the emotional part of things kind of comes up first. For some people, it might be the logical side of things. And so I usually need to engage in some sort of mindful practice, whether that's journaling, talk about it. I have various other things that I do so that my emotions aren't so high and I'm able to kind of calm down a little bit. And then I'm in a space. This is just what works for me. Then I'm in a space where I can use that logical part of my mind as well and my emotions, and recognize that, hey, I was really upset in this situation because, yeah, someone said something that was really rude or whatever it was, right? But the logical part is me like, okay, was that really worth your energy, you know, to keep thinking about this, or what can you really do? And that's where I'm able to start thinking and asking myself those questions. And mm-hmm. I've learned to like kind of see where I'm putting my energy, you know, because when you're just in your emotional mind, for me, I would just like spend, oh my gosh, like you were saying, like days.
It's exhausting.
It's so exhausting, right? And it's not productive. Like you don't get anywhere too, right? So I've learned, okay, my emotions are there. What's happening? Learn to calm down physiologically through deep breathing and different techniques that I use, then use that logical part. And that's where, like, that's how the wise mind works for me. For some people, it could be the opposite, where they're just so factual and logical and they ignore their emotions. So they have to learn to be more empathetic or understand their emotions and connect to things in different situations. And that's what using their wise mind looks like for them.
Yeah, as you guys are just talking, I'm thinking about emotional intelligence more and more and how that has an impact on just relationships, especially like if you're starting off, you know, getting married, and then, you know, there's always this pressure from the families, or they'll say, you know, banda banjuga ya jilavyakara luga, everything will be okay. And that's just like, you know, and there's so much there that emotional intelligence, if you have that, it can help you. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
That's totally taking no responsibility for your child there, and putting it all on the wife, right? Like, hopefully she can take care of this mess that we made, right? Yeah. And you want to talk about emotional, like whether we have emotional maturity or not, man? Go sit in a committee meeting once in a while, in a Godwara committee meeting, and you'll see some really funny stuff happening, right? Where people are fighting over microwave use or something like that. But on that note, like I wanted to say, for an example, like of, you know, in, like you were saying, emotional politics or whatever, you know, an example that just came to me was like how someone might say that the immigrants are taking your jobs, right? Or, you know, in America, there's, you know, like Trump was saying that, you know, there's rapists and murderers coming across the borders and I'm going to put that wall up. What did that do? That made everyone who said, I'm proud to be American, I've been born here, I'm raised here, right? And these outsiders are going to come get us, and they're going to, you know, and they're going to, you know, and we need to protect that. They're all emotional about it, right? They're not thinking logically. They're not thinking that, like, what is this guy saying? Like, you know, everyone that comes over is a rapist and a murderer. Like, you know what I mean? And like, an example on the other side would be like when Trudeau was caught doing blackface, I guess, right? Or brownface, right? When he had the Aladdin turban and stuff. Dude, I laughed so hard at that. I just laughed because I just found it funny, right? I'm like, if I was this guy's friend, I'd be like, dude, I would have an intervention with him, because not because I was offended, but because I was like, you take Halloween too seriously, bro. Like, why are you, like, you know, like doing like this much makeup for Halloween, right? I'm not saying that you should feel a certain way. I'm just saying how that was spun, right? To make, like, to just, you know, like, yes, some people were probably hurt by it, but people were getting upset with me that I wasn't hurt. Because I was just like, I don't know how to feel about that. It doesn't really affect me that much, man. You know what I mean? But like, I could see how many people were just trying to spin that and be like, you know, but you should feel like this, or you should feel like this is hurting you. And I was like, but I don't. You know what I mean? And I've seen real racism. Like, I've, you know, like almost every day of my life, like, you know, when I was younger, especially, I could see how people reacted to me, right? That for me was not really, it didn't affect me like that. But that's how, you know, people try so hard to put a smokescreen of emotion. That's why, you know, like, if we can get beyond our emotion and be more detached from our emotions in a positive way, we could be really a lot, really, really powerful.
Yeah. And like, the concept of the idea of getting married because, you know, that's going to make you feel better, or like make your kid more responsible and stuff, it's definitely just bypassing the need to connect to yourself and really work on yourself. And that's so important to do. You got to have that first in order to really be able to engage with another person and be in a relationship that's going to be successful, right? Oftentimes it's so easy to kind of point fingers and look at each other in a relationship, whatever that might be, a friendship, a romantic relationship, whatever. But you don't recognize what's happening within you, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of, there's a beautiful poem by Rupi Kaur that talks about, like, I don't remember it right now off the top of my head, but it's about having like both of your lights on within yourself, and then you're just making everything brighter. Mm-hmm. It's not that concept of you're my other half. It's no, we're each our own person, we're whole and complete. You're just making my life brighter. I have my light, you have your light, together we're like, you know,
shining.
Yeah, shining.
Yeah, I mean, I think like every, it's so helpful to have this information before you enter a relationship. Like you're able to work on yourself, and then the idea of like supporting each other after in a relationship and not trying to fix each other and
blame each other for your own issues.
Go ahead.
Well, that's one thing I've realized is that the biggest shift with me was when I started just taking responsibility for my issues instead of blaming the world around me. I was like, let's with a non-judgmental way, loving, whatever you want to say, but honestly taking a look at myself and be like, what's your role in this, right? Because and then when I started really realizing how important it is to take responsibility, that really shifted me, because I was like, if I'm responsible for me being so sad, then I'm also responsible for me being happy. So that if it's all on me, right? If it's all on me, that means that I can be happy as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that was really difficult. There were a lot of ups and downs, like even like during the beginning of like a marriage, not owning your part and not like not knowing what to do, or it was like, well, you have to think my way and that has to be it, and I'm not gonna take any responsibility for my actions or my, so just switching that around and being able to see things for the way they are, like that was huge. It made our relationship better, and it turned, not just with each other, but with all our, like with our family and everything too. I mean, you know, this whole idea of like a girl leaving her family behind and then entering another, it's tough. And you really, like, that's where just regulating your emotions, like, can be really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. There's so much that you have to do with, like, experiences like that. You know, any huge change in your life is going to come with more emotions. It's going to come with new experiences, and often it might be emotions you haven't felt before, not in the same intensity. And as you're making new relationships, your relationships are changing with other people, and whatever it might be for you, whether it's marriage, having a new baby, or starting a new job, or, you know, whatever it might be, or going into school, whatever phase you're at, or just going to high school, whatever it is for you, honestly, like every change in life comes with all these different emotions, and kind of learning what to do with it, and almost being okay with the process and going through it. It's so huge. We kind of talk about going through your emotions instead of bypassing them.
Right.
So I've been asked this question quite a few times, and like, what should you look for in a partner? You know, like when you've been married so many years, like a lot of people kind of come up with that question. And would you say like emotional maturity is like up there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's huge.
How would you recognize emotional maturity is the real question, I think, there?
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
In your opinions.
Yeah, having like having the ability to perhaps be humble and recognize like when you've made a mistake, when there's something you have to work on, being able to recognize like your strengths and other people's strengths as well, and be able to be a support for each other. I think like that ability to be empathetic, to kind of see what other people might be feeling, to get an idea of like what's it like to be in their shoes.
The ability to take responsibility for your own actions, instead of blaming others, I think is a huge sign.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's like, it's a journey, right? Like not every single person is going to be in that space. And that doesn't necessarily mean that maybe they're not the right person for you. Like maybe they'll come around and they'll learn, but like, you got to figure out like, what is it that you need in a person? And is that person growing? I think having a growth mindset is really big. Because as you get older, you're going to keep changing, right? And I think that happens in marriages too. Like, I've only been married for a year and a half, but whatever age you're at, just think about yourself developmentally. You've changed, right? From the time when I was 18 and I'm like, you know, 27 now, I think. I forget my age now, but you know, I've changed so much, you know? And so you're going to keep changing, and being in a space where you're open to that change and you're open to always being your best self, whatever that looks like. I think that's kind of how I've seen emotional maturity, like that it's more so about play out, you know. And even if someone's like, I don't think any partner is going to be perfect.
No.
I think that's a mistake that some people kind of take when they're trying to find a partner. Yeah. Is like, oh, this person has to have all these things, and you know, and like, are you perfect? Like, no one's perfect, you know? And the idea of perfection is not something that's real.
Yeah.
It's taken me a long time to kind of understand that. So I think learning that, these are the top things that are really important to me, whatever your values are. I think that's quite important. If you value similar things in your life, those are like the baseline things. Some of your values and beliefs. Your personality, do you click with the other person? You know, what's that like? You're not going to be the exact same.
Mm-hmm.
No one's the same as you, you know, we're each unique in our own ways, but do you vibe and whatever that means for you? And it's going to be unique for each person.
Absolutely. I was going to say the same thing, like a growth mindset. And like, honestly, like for us, it's been like a spiritual sort of connection, like that willingness to want to grow spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of been a foundation for us, like that love. And I'm curious, do you have any experience on like or any insight into like how watching violence can sort of impact, like if we take relationships further in like a family, how it can impact children and all that? That was just a question that I had.
Okay.
I wanted to get your take on.
Okay. Yeah. I think witnessing violence like as a child can really impact your growth. And there's been a lot of research that's come out recently around adverse childhood experiences. So witnessing abuse or experiencing abuse and how that it has been tied a lot to mental health concerns and addictions and whatnot in the as adults.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that not everyone recognizes sometimes for children. And so now there's more of an emphasis on, I mean, there probably always has been, but maybe more of an emphasis on having positive, healthy spaces for children. Because really, if we look at it from a bigger picture, that's what's going to create a healthier society, right? If we have healthier children. And
mm-hmm.
In our culture, a lot of parents have learned to kind of deal with emotions through violence at times, or perhaps like hitting and things like that. And it's been normalized because that's what their parents have done. And a lot of people in any culture, really, there's abuse that's there in different forms, like neglecting your children, or like whether there's like hitting between the parents or yelling, whatever that abuse looks like, there's just different forms.
Do you think that it stunts the ability to regulate emotions? Like, is there a link there?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it has to do with the emotions, right? And that's what, like, oftentimes struggling with your emotions in some way kind of leads to a lot of mental health concerns and addictions. Like, addictions is really just, like, trying to find a way to cope through your mental health, mm-hmm. honestly, right? Like, addictions, mental health, it's really the same thing. So there's no difference. We're all probably been addicted to one thing or another, even if it's not drugs and alcohol, right? Like, so it's huge, and learning and trying to break the cycle of abuse is so important. And working through our own trauma, like mm-hmm. I'm sure as you've become parents, like I know you've like shared some of your books and things that you've read with me and through my studies, and just learning that like as parents, you start to realize even more as your children copy you and do things, and you start thinking about yourself and your own childhood and just learning like whatever you've gone through, giving that space and attention to process that mm-hmm. is really helpful, because it's things happen automatically, right? When you've experienced abuse or witness abuse, you might not realize it, but things just happen and you don't know how to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes when it gets to a point where you don't know how to heal and what to do, that's where going to a professional is really helpful, you know, because they have tools and ways of helping you process that might be of support to you, and it might be hard for you to do that on your own.
Mm-hmm. So I know we talk about a lot of things, and I love our conversations every time we have them. So this might be a little off topic, but it's something that Saj and I have been sort of talking about and discussing, and I wanted to know your take on it, which is why I asked the violence question. We were talking about well, because of the Jai Sahib Zadeh event and all that, we were talking about children and Sikhi and how the impact of violence that is formed on their psyche, either from listening to stories or hearing about it and all that, and how perhaps there should, like for us, there's, we're kind of mindful of like the age at which, and every child is different and every parent's family is different, but we're trying to be mindful of the age at which we introduce what happened to our child's heroes, mm-hmm. really, because those are his heroes.
Right.
And is our child really able to comprehend what really happened
right.
when he's, you know, listening to violent stories? And okay, right. so this is actually something that I'm noticing in a lot of schools where they teach a lot of Sikhi, that, and it's kind of generational trauma as well, because we've grown up listening to like horrific real stories and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And that impact, like it's almost fear that you feel inside growing up, and it's sort of like planting a seed of fear in your psyche versus love.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your take on that?
I think looking at the developmental phase that your child is at, or whatever children are in your life, is quite important when you're sharing different stories. And I think that as a parent, like, you have your own instinct of what feels right, and you know your child. And I know for myself, that mostly like stories, when I started really learning about what things were happening, I was probably around 12 years old, I think. And at that point, I was in a space where like, I think I could understand more of those details and fathom some mm-hmm. concept. And it depends, like someone could be 12 years old, but not in that, be that space or be in there earlier. It's not necessarily your age, it's your child, right? And where they're at. I think like the idea of fear is something that, for me, like, I've reflected on this too in my own childhood. It was really good in a lot of ways too. Like, children to some degree need to have those rules and need to know that this is what I can do and I can't do and things like that. But knowing that, like, what happened in our history, and to seek, like, being able to explain to your child at a point where they're going to find that empowering instead of fear, something that's going to induce fear, I can see that as being really important.
Yeah, this is... this topic gets a little, it can get a little complicated. It probably takes a lot of time to discuss it with in depth, but I think I agree with you. I think we can't traumatize our children. And this might be a controversial statement, right? But when they see people who are dressed like them being bricked alive or whatever is happening, like Mirma News jails and stuff, mm-hmm. Maybe until they're emotionally ready, we should talk about the type of thinking that those Sahibzade they had to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember I did this once. I was talking about the Sahibzade they, and I was talking about their mind state. And this girl was like, but, you know, those bad people aren't around anymore, right? And it just clicked in my head that, wow, she's really afraid.
Mm-hmm.
That, hey, this person looks like me. This person was a Sikh and they hurt this person. Mm-hmm. They could hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the trauma, mm-hmm. the generational trauma mm-hmm. that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that we recognize that
mm-hmm.
and we focus until they're ready. And this is just my opinion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you see it like with these cartoons that are out now too. Like mm-hmm. parents are just, they're putting it in front of their kids. They're like, oh, watch this, learn your history, right?
Mm-hmm.
It might be a 6-year-old or, you know, who doesn't understand, or a 5-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, let's talk about their sochni. Mm-hmm. Like, how deep was their sochni? How high was their intellect
yeah.
to be able to recognize this at that age,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's an amazing, beautiful thing in itself, right? But yeah, I think that's something that can be very, very
mm-hmm.
problematic, right? If we go there. Yeah, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, so I think, like, I really appreciated what you just said of, like, focusing more on their mindset. And I think that's something that we might overlook sometimes when we think about our history and the Shahidis. Focusing so much on, like, what physically happened. It's, I think, Maharaj, those stories are there, and Maharaj, like, you know, that happened in our history to show the strength and that mindset of what was happening, not, like, actually, like, you know, the details of what happened, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really beautiful way. And that's like, fortunately, that's how I was taught in a lot of like the camps I got to go to when I was young and you were teaching things, was just learning about what those Sikhs did and how they were mentally strong, and that reading Gurbani made them strong. And, you know, because you have to teach things in a developmental way that suits the child, right? And that could be something that, honestly, we're in a space where we have that education and awareness and privilege of knowing that. But I can see that a lot of people in our community probably don't know that. And they think, oh, I'm just teaching what happened. Like, this is important to know who you are and where you came from. Yes, it is. But phrasing it in a way that's like fits for that child and their understanding, and making it so it's helpful for them and serving them and not terrifying them, because we don't want to re-traumatize our children.
Yeah, exactly. And even back then when I wasn't so self-aware, I heard the stories over and over again, year after year after year after year after year after year. And it was just like this pump, and then you would go back to your life where you're just emotionally up and down. And that's when I started teaching with like, okay, what made them strong? Why don't we focus on that? Even then I was still like, you know, let's focus on what made them strong instead of just like focusing on what happened to them, right? Yeah. And I see that now a lot more too, like through social media. Mm-hmm. People are just like, you know, so like emotional about it, crying and everything and singing and everything. And it's fine. You should never forget, like you said, right? But let's go beyond that and see, how do we get to that type of mind state where you're so detached from your identity that you're in the state of blissful surrender, I guess you can call it, right? Like, how do we get there, right? Why don't we work on ourselves, right? And try to live that life. So like on that note, I think, you know, it's been a really good discussion. We've unpacked a lot of things here. Just to like summarize it really quick, right? I know I don't want to put you on the spot, but you've done so well and amazing, right? I think you can handle it. Do you have any advice to people who are listening, how to start off on a better mental health journey?
I think starting the process of connecting to yourself, whatever that looks like for you, is probably the first step. Yeah. So different ways of doing that is starting to actually talk about what you're experiencing with people that you feel like will be supportive for you, and taking that, being brave about it, you know, and that might be, you know, coming to a therapist. If you don't feel like people in your life are able to hear you out in a non-judgmental way, that's okay. It's okay to go to therapy, you know, that's why it exists. You would go to your doctor if you feel really sick, right? Like, you wouldn't just stay at home and say, I'm not going to the doctor. You know, if you're not getting better, you would go. So
sorry, I just want to add to that. So sometimes you have to find the right fit,
yes,
right, with a therapist. So just because you go to one therapist and that doesn't work for you doesn't mean that you shouldn't continue looking.
Yes, definitely. You definitely have to, like, therapists, we're just people, right? We each have a different approach. Not every single person is going to be the same. You might vibe with someone's energy, their personality, their cultural background can make a difference. Like, for myself, you know, I've definitely felt that there's differences between people who practice more culturally with cultural awareness and sensitivity versus other people who don't. And it just really depends, right? Like, and it's a little bit of like therapist shopping, honestly. And yes, it can be tedious because you're like making that first step. And it's like so hard to go and talk to people and tell your story over and over again. And I get it, right? It's a struggle. But sometimes you have to find the right fit, definitely. And that's important. And being honest with your therapist, you know, like whenever I practice with my clients, I ask them, like, be honest with me, give me feedback. I want to hear if what we're doing isn't working. I'll try and take a different approach. So I don't look at clients as being like resistant. Like, that's not a word that exists in my practice. It's more so like, what can I do to try and meet you where you're at? And a lot of therapists might have that perspective, and, you know, and so share, like, you felt uncomfortable with something and maybe they can change it. If they can't, like, you know, go elsewhere. And there's different ways to also have that practice with yourself. Like, journaling is huge. And doing journaling in a way where you're also incorporating some self-compassion and gratitude, right? Like, yes, write about what's happening, but also reinforce some positive shifts for yourself through gratitude, journaling, or like reflecting back and being self-compassionate towards yourself as well in your journaling, and not just like being critical. Doing deep breathing, very simple, but it can be very powerful. It physiologically really calm you down, and that's huge in regulating your emotions. Meditating, try different yoga classes or meditation classes. Do it with other people if that's helpful. You know, there's so many things online where you can find guided meditations and yoga, and like explore what your faith is, your community. Connecting to other people is really important as well, and finding people around you that are going to support you in your healing, whatever it is. And kind of doing that on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Right. Sometimes we do something like, oh, I'll try today and that's it. Like the way that you've been has been for so many years in your life. Right. Like learning, like your brain has the capacity to rewire itself, like, and it can change. You can do that. That is totally possible. But it's something you have to be dedicated to and do it every day.
And trying it in different ways. Yeah. So if meditation, one type of meditation doesn't work, try a different. Exactly. I mean, you keep trying until you find something that really it works for you.
Exactly. There's so many different methods and so many different ways of kind of having that time for yourself, right? And developing that self-love and taking care of yourself, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, it's a journey. That's why I call it a journey. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going somewhere, there's different steps, different directions. You kind of have to walk around, figure it out, explore, be open to all of it, and kind of see like which direction it fits you best.
So the most important factor in this is please do take that first step, whatever it may look like to you. Realize that mental health is not something that should be stigmatized, mm-hmm. right? And it's something that we need to take care of, right? It's like your physical health, mm-hmm. right? It's, you have your spiritual health, you have your mental health, and it's all interconnected. Do you want to say anything, Amin, like a suggestion on what people can do maybe or no? Or yeah, Harleen, you said everything. Thank you so much for being here. I would just say that, you know, guys, just take that step, you know, to love each other, love yourself. I think it's super important. And I hope that, you know, we could bring more shows like this with great guests like you, Harleen. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'll just let you give a shout out to your Instagram if people want to, you know, follow you and stuff. And
sure. Blooming Minds Counseling, and counseling is spelled with two L's on Instagram.
And also, you know, we have a lot of tips and tricks on... Sorry? And books on the Mindful Dissy Instagram account. So please do check that out as well. And, you know, if you're listening, you already know, please show some love to the Sikhist, S-I-K-H-I-S-T. Thank you all for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed that. Stay blessed.